Welcome to the Vinyl Preacher, your weekly podcast where I never know what the music will be until it plays. I'm Matt Cadle, pastor at St. Mark's Lutheran Church in Los Angeles, California.
And I'm Zach Ferris. I am the pastor of Lutheran Campus Ministry here at the University of Colorado Boulder, and I still haven't found what it is I'm looking for.
Zach, it's that song from Sing 2.
Have you heard about Sing 3?
No.
Me either, but I can't wait.
Maybe it'll be an REM reunion. It'd be really great. Oh, Michael Stipe plays like...
These days. Michael Stipe is definitely... Number one, Michael Stipe definitely going to sell out and do a movie because that's his thing.
Losing My Religion could be great.
And the kids these days, they love a good 80s alternative band.
Mm-hmm. Yep. It's true. It's true.
What's next in Sing 4? Radiohead?
It'd be pretty incredible. Creep.
You want to see reclusive lead singers of rock bands from the 1900s.
Well,
we're going to take it to the next level.
Perhaps I'm pulling the wrong thread with reclusive. I don't know.
Again, I'm not sure, Matt. You're in Los Angeles. You're in Hollywood. Sing 2, as we all recall, greatest film of the year. I'm not sure what year it came out in. I don't know if the Oscar for Best Acting has been awarded in the appropriate time frame, but clearly it is Bono. I'm sure I've said it on the podcast before. Bono playing a reclusive rock star is the biggest stretch ever.
He was so reclusive.
The least
it was so hard to convince him to come. It's almost as if he was just waiting for someone to come and knock on his door so that he could make a triumphant return.
What a film.
Yeah. So, thanks to Sing 2, there are some U2 fans, in the young children's set, your Sunday school spark age level set. Unfortunately, when I talked to the high school kids about U2 and tried to bring up some songs, you know, like in Sing 2, they clearly had no idea what I was talking about.
So really?
We totally missed the teenage set.
The youth these days.
With that one, there's going to be a gap of U2 fans. It'll be 40 and up, and then maybe 5 and under. So...
We've clearly articulated on this podcast a number of times that our entrepreneurial future is in producing church education materials that no one is interested in. And I think, I don't know if it's already out there, but a godly play Montessori style version of a U2 Christ needs to be happening right now, man.
A Montessori version of a U2 Christ. Amazing. Amazing stuff.
I mean, what kid can't relate? I still haven't found what I'm looking for. My kid can't find anything they've ever looked for. It might be because their room is an absolute disaster.
Yeah. Yeah. I hear that. I can relate to that. They also, my children like to extend that disaster area into the floor of my car. Like the just, you know, like it just becomes full of craft projects and, yeah, got to clean it out on a regular basis.
I'm really grateful, Matt, for summer day camps. My child has gone to summer day camps most weeks in the summer because without them, I don't know what I would do. And yet, Matt, I'm not that grateful for all of the craft projects that come home every day because we have like a mountain of mostly half to one quarter finished craft projects. The other night, I don't know if you've been watching that. I don't know if you're caught up. We've been talking about films. Let's transition to a little thing we call the small screen, which these days is the big screen. On Hulu, Only Murderers in the Building. I've got some terrifying news. One of the big plot points is the glitter guy is clearly the murderer, right? And they've been chasing glitter guy around, and there's like three episodes where they don't let you know who glitter guy is. And the craft explosion that has happened at my house is so severe, man, that the other night I was getting ready for bed and my wife said, "Did you have glitter on your back?"
Wow.
The night before I went on my big like backpacking trip that we talked about last week, our daughter joined us in bed and was sleeping on top of me. And normally we fight that, right? And like, we're like, get her up and take her back to her bed. And that's not what we do. And it's not our routine. But I had to wake up at like 5 o'clock to get driving up into the mountains. And so I was like, you know what? I just need to sleep, man. So I got out of bed and went and laid down in her bed and fell asleep and got up in the morning and threw everything in the car, and we drove, you know, hours to the trailhead. And when I got out at the car at the trailhead, Matt, and got ready to put my boots on, because you don't want to put them on too soon because you're going to be wearing them for quite a while. My feet were bedazzled, Matt. They had glitter, they had stickery gems, gemstones all over them. So that's where we're at. I might be the murderer from Only Murderers. Only Murders in the Villain.
Only Murders or Only Murderers. You could be Glitter Guy. Yeah.
I could be Glitter Guy.
Incredible. Yeah. It's a good dad cast. It's good.
Oh, we got all the dad information here on the Vinyl Breach.
A lot of good television that we're referencing. Only Murders. I feel like it's gotten into its groove.
It has gotten into its groove. I've been a little frustrated by it. In that, like, I didn't feel like it was really clear. Again, Matt, I don't know if you're caught up with where we're at right now, so I'm not going to try to spoil things. The Glitter Guy has been identified, and I think we're at a stage where, like, what they're going to do is now, like, because it's the perfect thing to do, right? Like, in the second season, is not, you think it's going to be about who did it, right? Mm-hmm. But we've made the twist now where, like, oh, this person clearly did it, but now how is it going to result? Like, how are they going to get them and stuff, you know? Whereas the first season was more about who was more of a classic whodunit, as they say in the business. You know that, Matt, down there in Hollywood.
Yeah.
But it felt like a little whodunity for so long, and like it wasn't clear. Like it wasn't even like, I didn't even feel like they were good suspects.
Mm-hmm.
You know what I'm saying? Like nobody was a convincing suspect. And then like it's a person, and you're like, oh, I guess so. Yeah.
I mean, coming back, you're like, oh yeah, they cast that actor. They must be going to do something with him. But
do you know who the Glitter Guy is,
Chris? Well, I think I'm caught up through the Blackout episode. But Chris thinks there's one more twist. She's like, no, it can't be. They're gonna twist it again. I don't know. I mean,
the twist is, how does the Glitter Guy? Well, spoilers, friends. How does the Glitter Guy know that there are tunnels and stuff inside of the building?
Good question. You could get a flashback.
How do you
connect? It's going to be a flashback episode.
Obvious. They love a good flashback. I think it has something to do with that original party. I think everything comes out of that party where the person fell off the roof or what have you.
You think it's that? Or is it going to be what's the party? The murder mystery party from the 70s.
Oh, yeah.
Oh, so much good stuff. I will say I continue to appreciate Martin Short's character's commitment to dips. That he just only eats dips.
Wow. So that dude does.
It turns out there may be some family complications, but he's still committed to dips. Dips are so good.
Wow. I just love Martin Short, Matt. Like Martin Short, underappreciated.
Who would have thought in 2022 we'd have the Martin Short-a-sons?
Jiminy Glick was I loved that show when it came out. It was so far ahead of its time that you can't find it on YouTube and stuff. Like it's pre-internet, really, or internet video. And the few clips you can find are incredible. I just love it. So much. I mean, it's Between Two Ferns before Between Two Ferns, really. And his character is not that far away. It's just a different version of the character he plays on Only Murders in the Building. Like the New Yorker, like connected, like constant name dropping sort of thing. But yeah. Also buffoonish and stuff. It's amazing.
Right. Yeah. Solid stuff. What We Do in the Shadows? Are you caught up?
I'm caught up. Watched it last night.
I feel like it took a few episodes, and then I don't remember if it was the Night Market or the one before that I was like, okay, we're fully in. I think when Child Colin Robinson got a YouTube channel, I was like, this is yep.
I I love, you know, it comes as no surprise, I think, to our most of our listeners that I enjoy oddball, wacky comedy stuff. And this is it, Matt. And I just want to lift up right now as we're in the middle of, is this the third season of What We Do in the Shadows or fourth season?
Four. I think we're at four.
Gosh, four. That the end of last season was a cliffhanger where
they did nothing with
Guillermo got thrown into a coffin and closed shut and stuck on a ship that went across the ocean. Like, and you're like, oh my gosh, what's going to happen? They threw me there with like a bag of Cheetos and some Oreos. And then they just come back and they hardly address it at all. Just like, no, no, we're all back now. It's fine.
Yeah.
The Landor cosmetic surgery episode is insane. I mean, such. Landor the Relentless, one of the vampires, has somehow stumbled upon having a djinn and has access to djinn magic. And
which I love the way they play the djinn. Just, yeah, he's just.
He does the wishes by clicking a pin, which is incredible, and seems incredibly annoyed, but is omnipresent in every episode.
Yep.
And so he wastes like a million wishes on. I mean, because it's so funny, because it's like that's how cosmetic surgery works.
He won't fix the house.
He won't fix the house.
But he's gonna, after he does a couple things, he's gonna move into philanthropy eventually. It's just.
Oh my gosh. And it's not clear how many wishes he has. It just, and then he runs out.
It's, yeah. Oh my gosh. It's going to run out. It's going to run out.
Wow.
Anyway, check it out, listeners.
Check it out. If you're really into What We Do in the Shadows, or you're, I don't know, that's not usually up my alley. I know some folks are really into crimey podcasts and stuff. That's not usually a thing I like, but you know, maybe if you want to talk about, come on, you're an expert. You want to talk about only murders or only murderers in the building. We could do an app.
Could do it. Good stuff. Yeah. Well, this has been another good episode of
before we close up the bag here. On HBO Max now, you can watch New Zealandish like paranormal police show. Have you seen this? It's with,
I think I've heard of it because it isn't like the same universe as.
Yeah. It's real mad. And what's his name? The creator?
Taika?
Taika, yeah. Is behind it. And Wellington Paranormal. You got to check it out. It's police. Right. And it is.
New Zealand humor.
It's so good. Who knew the Kiwis? So good. The ridiculousness of humor. Well, Matt, I don't know that any of that's going to preach. And I think people are going to have to preach on August the 21st.
I think so. But we've got some familiar texts, especially this first one. So here they are. Time for the texts.
Well, I'm going to give you a challenge again, Matt, because yeah. I've read these texts.
Okay.
What's
the challenge? I'm
not into them right now. I did not feel particularly inspired. So,
okay.
See what you can do for me.
Isaiah 58, 9b-14. This is our familiar, one of the familiar Ash Wednesday texts, usually assigned for Ash Wednesday. So if you use this every year or even every other year, you probably know it
Nothing well. Like Ash Wednesday in August. That's what...
You know, yeah. And I think, I still like, you know, sometimes you've heard a text read and you just always remember that, either remember the sermon or remember the text read. And I'll say for me, I probably didn't know this text very well until I was in seminary, and it was probably first year. And it was Ash Wednesday. And I'm pretty sure it was Angela Kabeb who now, is sometimes on TV,
same, Lutheran yeah. World,
right? Yeah, Family Feud. She's sometimes on the Today Show or stuff like that. But she's a great preacher and was a great reader that day and read this text with just read this text so well, and it just has always stuck with me. So anyway, here it is, Isaiah 58. If you remove the yoke from among you, the pointing of the finger, the speaking of evil, if you offer your food to the hungry and satisfy the needs of the afflicted, then your light shall rise in the darkness and your gloom be like the noonday. The Lord will guide you continually and satisfy your needs in parched places and make your bones strong.
The gospel.
And you
of
shall be. That's right. You shall be like a watered garden, like a spring of water whose waters never fail. Your ancient ruins shall be rebuilt. You shall raise up the foundations of many generations. You shall be called the repairer of the breach, the restorer of streets to live in. If you refrain from trampling the Sabbath, from pursuing your own interests on my holy day, if you call the Sabbath a delight and the holy day of the Lord honorable, if you honor it, not going your own ways, serving your own interests, pursuing your own affairs, then you shall take delight in the Lord, and I will make you ride upon the heights of the earth. Ooh, I will feed you with the heritage of your ancestor Jacob, for the mouth of the Lord has spoken. Word of God, word of life.
Thanks be to God. You know, I didn't know. I did not recall that this was an Ash Wednesday text until you mentioned it.
I think it starts a little earlier and maybe ends a little earlier, but that core piece there at the beginning, definitely there. I think what stands out to me, especially this Sunday, and this is going to tie into the gospel, is that tie. I mean, it gives you this ethical command, right? Very justice-y, really good stuff, but it ties it so closely to the Sabbath. And we're going to see that in the gospel of what is the Sabbath for. And so to call back this text seems really important on that Sunday. But I also wonder if it is just a helpful, like, you know, again, I think last week we talked about accountability and kind of checking ourselves against the word to make sure we're on the right track. And this would be a good one for your Sunday. This is you know, our Sabbath, our worship. Is it about our own interests or pursuing what we think is holy, or even just praising God, perhaps true praise, offer your food to the hungry, satisfy the needs of the afflicted, that focus on gathering, you know, gathering up the offering at the table and distributing it to those in need. Yeah, it's an opportunity to rethink what it is Sunday is for.
This is a very, a lot of Girardian threads here, Matt. Satan literally means the accuser here. And that is, that understanding of Satan and evil is a big part of Girardian thought. And that's what you get here. If you remove the yoke from among you, if you remove the pointing of the finger, the speaking of evil, the division, the scapegoating, that divides up the people of God and God's creation. That's the evil that Isaiah is talking about. And that then it moves into a wholeness, right? I'm struck by the, you shall be called repairer of the breach, which should be the name of your church, right? Repairer of the breach, Lutheran Church would be pretty cool. And it moves on to the restorer of streets to live in. Repairer of the breach, obviously, taking, netting together the broken pieces of the world and of creation. But a note about streets. Matt, I grew up in North Carolina, which among many things is, likes to call itself, one of the official state nicknames is the Good Roads State, which seems like a silly thing to call yourself these days, right? And maybe it is, but as a former civil engineer person with a degree, we take civilization for granted, and infrastructure and roads, right? Like, they did not exist always. They don't exist unless we build them and maintain them. And what they are for, especially ancient peoples, are connectors. They connect communities and people. When you have roads that are in disrepair, communities, societies are divided. And so here, the gospel world that Isaiah is proclaiming is a world in which the people are connected and together. They're gathered together, as you were alluding to.
Amen. I like that focus on streets. Indiana was the crossroads of America. So, yeah, streets, roads, it's important stuff.
Where we're going, Matt. We don't need roads.
We don't need roads. Wow, what a reference. Oh,
it's not what Isaiah is saying.
There's a local church in our neighborhood that they do a lot of work on safe streets and redesigning the street that they're on. They've raised money for grants and are doing different kinds of planning around, like, the neighborhood street, which has very little to do with, you know, I don't know, praise and worship, but seems to be, like, really core to their mission, is creating neighborhoods to live in. And here it is right here in Isaiah, restorer of streets to live in. I mean, what if you thought about that as part of your church's mission? We're caring for this neighborhood. We're caring for this street, like literally this street. I think about worship in that way. They should have assigned this for God's Work Our Hands Sunday. What are we doing with this in the middle of August? We do this once a year, not every Sunday. Come on.
I've complained to our friend Peter Severson of Lutheran Advocacy Ministry in Colorado, dear friend with whom we do a podcast. I do a podcast from time to time about how our advocacy stuff is so focused on, understandably focused on national and state politics and issues, and those need to be addressed. And yet, and this is partially my civil engineering background. I'm really convinced that some of the most formative decisions that happen in local government happen local zoning committees that really affect how we live. I think we could have a lot more like bang for our buck in terms of advocacy if we focused on, right, like shaping building codes in our communities, because, you know, we're in the West where, I don't know if it's a Western thing, where we both live. Affordable housing is an incredibly difficult, it's such a difficult issue. And partially it's only a difficult issue because we built building codes and zoning stuff that makes it a difficult issue. You know, that's the double-sided sword that is bolder, that it is beautiful. And we have laws and regulations that make it, that seek to preserve the natural beauty of this place, that you can't build a building over three stories. And that makes sense. And you can't build like above a certain elevation, so you can't build into the mountains. And we've got green space around the community, and so you can't build wider that way. And so then you've created a really limited capacity for people to live. And the way economics works makes that really difficult for the people who work across the street from my office here, right? Cleaning dorms and serving food to students. They can't live here because of stuff. So, yeah. And that's real and affects us in really significant ways. So I'm with you, Matt. Like, I'd holler at us if your church advocacy committee is focused on shaping zoning and building codes.
Yeah. Our organizing team was recently at a zoning commission hearing. It was fascinating stuff. So yeah, if your church is doing it now, this would be a perfect opportunity to lift it up for the congregation of how important it is. And if you're not, another opportunity to lift it up. So yes, amen to all of them. Hebrews.
Well, Matt, this Hebrews.
We still in Hebrews? We still in it?
This is 3 of 4. I think we get it one more week after this, which is a shame, Matt. It's the shameful thing about the lectionary, you know, which, you know, generally we're pro revised common lectionary. Thanks be to God. The narrative lectionary movement has died down a bit, at least in my how I've perceived it. I kid.
Well, I feel like there's more. There's actually more now, right? Because you've got like the women's lectionary. I feel like there's another one too. There's a couple of them. So maybe there's been a proliferation.
Dang. That's why you come to this podcast. You get big words. Only 4 weeks in Hebrews. You don't have time to unpack it, right? And like set the context and stuff. Yet it's full of good imagery and probably is worth unpacking. So. I'll allow it if you want to do a sermon series on Hebrews or a particular book that gets neglected, like Acts. You know, we always complain about Acts on this podcast. It's full of good stuff and gets stuck as the second or first reading during the season of Easter when you're least likely to talk about it and you're going to talk about all the gospel texts with the resurrected Jesus. But here we are while we got it. We're getting towards the very, very end. There are only 13 chapters in Hebrews. You have come. You have not come to something that can be touched, Matt, a blazing fire and darkness and gloom and a tempest and the sound of a trumpet and a voice whose words made the hearers beg that not another word be spoken to them. For they could not endure the order that was given. If even an animal touches the mountain, and we're alluding here to Mount Sinai, because this is a fairly obscure verse in Exodus and Deuteronomy, that if even an animal touches the mountain, it shall be stoned to death. Indeed, so terrifying was the sight that Moses said, I tremble with fear. But you, You have come to Mount Zion and to the city of the living God, the heavenly Jerusalem, and to innumerable angels in festal gathering, and to the assembly of the firstborn who are enrolled in heaven. It's an open enrollment kind of a situation with the people of God. And to God, the judge of all, and to the spirits of the righteous made perfect, and to Jesus, the mediator of the new covenant, and to the sprinkled blood that speaks a better word than the blood of Abel. Woo, we're hitting another Girardian note, Matt. This is Girardian week. See that you do not refuse the one who is speaking, for if they did not escape when they refused the one who warned them on earth, how much less will we escape if we reject the one who warns from heaven? At that time, his voice shook the earth, but now he has promised, yet once more I will shake not only the earth, but also the heaven. And the phrase yet once more indicates the removal of what was shaken, that is, created things, so that what cannot be shaken may remain. Therefore, since we are receiving a kingdom that cannot be shaken, Matt, for all you folks who live in earthquake country, let us give thanks, by which we offer to God an acceptable worship with reverence and awe, for indeed our God is a consuming fire. The word of the Lord.
Thanks be to God. Consuming fire.
So a lot of imagery here, and just the briefest bit of context is that you got some compare and contrast going on, obviously. It's not real clear on first reading what is being compared and contrast, but you are comparing Mount Sinai, which is where the law is delivered to Moses, right? Where humanity encounters the fullness of God's presence with that the time when Moses gets to see God's backside, full revelation, shaking, all that kind of stuff. And they're comparing, Hebrews here is comparing the reaction of the people to that revelation on the mountain, right? That, as you recall, Moses comes down the mountain and finds golden calves and throws down the stones, right? And they break. That there is a lack of faithfulness in response to that revelation on the mountain. And over and against that here, Hebrews is lifting up a not real, tangible mountain, Mount Zion, a place that cannot be touched, right? As this new full mountain that they're being called to, and is urging the people to respond in a different manner than that the folks did at Mount Sinai. The other thing is that it lifts up Esau right before this. And so it's doing some like, don't be an Esau sort of thing. Esau traded the untangible promise of an inheritance for one bowl of lentils. So there are significant elements of the tangible versus the intangible, which can be a little uncomfortable for most mainstream Protestant preachers.
Yeah, there's amazing imagery in here, and like you said, you really need a sermon series to truly unpack all of it, but maybe the connective tissue is that there's an agitational sense, I feel like, to these texts in August. There's something agitational about it. There's that accountability, there's that shake you up, there's that check yourself. And I think this this image of this God that's a consuming fire that shakes the earth, I think maybe that's some of the connective tissue. But it'd be tough to, if you're going to only preach on Hebrews, I don't know.
Yeah.
It did a lot of work. Take a lot.
To connect it a bit to the Isaiah and to the gospel, I think one of the connective pieces is there's this movement from the tangible to the intangible, right? That Sinai is a tangible place and that this new thing is intangible. And so you might be tempted to slip really quickly into the intangible stuff is better than the tangible stuff, which is where it starts to get a little icky for me. You know, Esau probably didn't make the best choice, but, you know, hungry people deserve to eat as well. Tangible food in addition to the intangible food. But it's interesting that it does come around. I think you can read it as a pretty tangible promise in the end that their correct response, the response that the writer of Hebrews is trying to produce in the people is, let us give thanks by which we offer to God an acceptable worship with reverence and awe. And the way we do worship is in community, right? With the fullness of a community And so there's something really tangible about that. And so it actually moves us back into the way that the intangible promise becomes tangible, that the fullness is achieved.
Nice. I like that move. Luke.
Luke. Very slowly making our way through Luke here, man.
Now Jesus was teaching in one of the synagogues on the Sabbath, and just then there appeared a woman with a spirit that had crippled her for 18 years. She was bent over and was quite unable to stand up straight. When Jesus saw her, he called her over and said, "Woman, you are set free from your ailment." And when he laid his hands on her, immediately she stood up straight and began praising God. But the leader of the synagogue, indignant because Jesus had cured on the Sabbath, kept saying to the crowd, "There are 6 days on which work ought to be done. Come on those days and be cured, and not on the Sabbath day." But the Lord answered him and said, "You hypocrites, does not each of you on the Sabbath untie his ox or his donkey from the manger and lead it away to give it water? And ought not this woman, a daughter of Abraham, whom Satan bound for 18 long years, be set free from this bondage on the Sabbath day?" And when he said all this, his opponents were put to shame, and the entire crowd was rejoicing at all the wonderful things he was doing. Gospel of the Lord.
Praise to you, O Christ. Well, this is a good one, Matt. So maybe I was wrong. So there's context here too, though, and that needs to be said. And that in the ancient Near East, illness was a sign of God's lack of favor. It was a bad thing. Like, you did something to deserve it. I don't think that. Most of us don't think that these days, but that is the reality for how it was seen. As a result of that thinking, if someone has a long-term illness, a condition, or something that causes a lack of cleanliness, what it means is that within folks who cared about the kind of purity culture of maintaining the law, they were exiled, right? And so one of the things that's happening here is that when Jesus heals the woman, it not only is curing her health issues, it's restoring her to the fullness of the community. It's making the community full. And I think that is a really important note. And in fact, right, like that's, you're going to get pushed down to, like, I think the good news is that there are some things that Jesus thinks are more important than the law, that Jesus is willing to do, even if it breaks our expectations, right? And restoring people to wholeness, whether that's a physical thing or whether that's to the wholeness of the community from which they've been exiled or scapegoated, is a thing that Jesus is willing to break the tradition in order to do.
Yes. Yes to all of that. And I feel like it's relevant that the particular kind of ailment that she has is this being bent over, right? That she's unable to stand up straight. And I think there's this connection to a community that's bent over and unable to stand up straight because of Roman oppression. And there is this sense of being set. And so he says, "You are set free from your ailment," and invites her to stand up straight. It's just such a powerful, just physical movement. I mean, if you were going to act this one out, I mean, it is, I'm trying to think of, like, I don't know. There are different kinds of illnesses Jesus can heal from, right? But this particular thing, it's both like this specific thing that this individual is healed from, but there's also just that movement of being bent over to being standing up straight. It's just such a powerful move, I think. And for Jesus to be inviting us to stand up straight is, yeah.
It is a physical embodiment of Luther's, like, incurvatus se, right? That Luther's understanding of primary definition of sin is to be turned in upon oneself, to be, and, you know, there is a line to walk here that we have a more advanced, or I'd like to think, better understanding of how sickness works and those sorts of afflictions work. But for these people, this was a sign of the woman's sinfulness. So you got to walk that line. So you don't want to accidentally have people hear that, you know, being sick is a sign of, it happens because you're sinful. So it's not the woman's fault here, but it is still the opportunity for a really powerful image of what it looks like to be turned in upon oneself, as Luther would say, right? And that to be stood back up and to be made whole into the community is I think that image speaks to it, that you don't care for and live in the community when you are turned in upon one yourself, focused upon yourself.
Yeah. And I think that image too of like, I mean, the way it's described, just then there appeared a woman with a spirit that had crippled her for 18 years. And so there's this, this personification of the illness itself, but it also like takes it away from, it's not like she is, yeah. There's a woman, he could have said there's a woman who had been crippled for 18 years or who had been bent over for 18, but with a spirit that had crippled her, that was acting upon her. And then Jesus even repeats it later when he says, whom Satan bound for 18 long years, that then she is set free to be her full self, to be who God created her to be. So she is set free from this spirit that is externally acting upon her. And I think that's an interesting, it's just a different way of framing it. The text is pretty clear. That's what the, like, it comes up twice, the way that that's framed.
Yeah. Yeah. I like it, man. The other big context piece that can be helpful in understanding this, because there's two kind of scenes. Jesus does the healing and then is confronted by the leader of the synagogue because Jesus is breaking the Sabbath. And it is helpful to understand that in that Jesus kind of inaugurates his ministry in Luke by saying, I've come to proclaim the year of the Lord's favor, to release the captives, to do all that. He's established, he's saying, I have come to inaugurate a year of Sabbath. Hmm. And so the scale of what is happening here is that, I think that's a part of what Jesus is doing, is recalibrating our understanding of the scale, that the leaders of the synagogue are really focused on this really small picture of what's going on. And Jesus is in part making an argument that he's not breaking the Sabbath, you know, which is an interesting thing. Like, he could say the Sabbath isn't that important. There are things more important than the Sabbath. But he's reframing what Sabbath is and how it works. And he's got a much bigger idea in mind, bigger understanding, grander, more cosmic understanding of what the Sabbath is and how it functions, how it should function in the world than these leaders in the synagogue.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Agreed. I'm curious what this 18 years is about. It makes me want to do more research, but I don't. I haven't done it. So listeners, call in.
I mean, 18 years is a long time. That's a long time. When your life expectancy is 30, that's quite a bit.
Yeah. Yeah. Just one of us fun with that. Interesting stuff.
But we should work on an interpretation of the Bible where we adjust all the figures for inflation and increased life expectancy.
Yeah.
People, again, speaking of Christian education resources, nobody wants.
It'd be a good project. Again, I just want to reiterate, if you have any inclination to act things out, or even just have some folks pantomime stuff in worship, if you ever get to some creative arts, I feel like this is one of those where if you see it, it has a certain kind of power, the physical movement of what happens here. In the same way that there's like a power when you do turn the other cheek and you see what's really happening in that story. I feel like this is a similar kind of move. So yeah, illustrate it for your people.
Do it. Well, Matt, we should listen to music this week.
Let's do it. What do you got for Sing 3?
Well, for Sing 3, I am going to start with Sing 3's already signed on. REM is getting back together for Sing 3. You heard it here first. Your trusted source for breaking news in the music industry. And obviously, Matt, you got to go with the lead track off of the 1990 Warner Brothers, the inaugural Warner Brothers release of REM. Really exciting, men. They came together and they put an album together called Green. Ironically, it is orange. And it starts with a song, lead track, called Stand, Matt. And that's what Jesus says, stand up. And so stand in the place where you are.
Amen.
And it's instructive, just like the first two readings, you know. Now turn Wes, think about direction. Wonder why you have it. It tells you what to do. It's great. Then, Matt, I love this. You know, who doesn't love a good mountain story and mountain image? And we've got two mountains here. We're caught between Sinai and Mount Zion. And for people, what a beautiful image of the people of God caught between these two mountains, living in the valley, trying to figure out which way is up. Gregory Alan Isaacoff, who, I don't know, hasn't had a moment, I don't think yet. Like, I don't think is fully appreciated the way that he should be. Colorado-based, Denver-based singer, songwriter, has a beautiful song called San Luis. It's about the San Luis Valley, which is kind of like the San Joaquin Valley of Colorado. It's where the great sand dunes are. It's this massive valley, Alamosa, out there where a lot of agricultural stuff happens. And there's a beautiful, Matt, beautiful music video about the San Luis Valley here. The music video is great. So San Luis, Gregory Alan Isaacoff. And then I'm going Cage the Elephant, Ain't No Rest for the Wicked, because that's part of what Jesus is saying here. And then Soccer Mommy, which makes me feel weird every time I say it out loud, is really growing on me. It's got that great cover of Wide Open Spaces by the Chicks. They've got a song off their 2022 release called Bones that you should check out. And it's an excellent addition to this week's playlist.
Awesome. Love it. Good stuff. I was also thinking about those Bones. I'm going to throw on The Bones by Maren Morris with Hozier guesting on that. Good stuff. It keeps showing up in these when Spotify makes me a playlist based on the music that I listen to.
I was also looking at The Bones, which can be feels a little cheesy, you know?
Yeah.
But I was looking at the lyrics and I kept like wanting to be like, oh, I'll find a different Bones song. It'll be fine. But then I like read the lyrics and I'm like, oh, this actually, there are several connections here. Like I, and then I came back to our live document you were editing and you had already added it. So I was like,
I added it. I got it in there. I'll
be the guy who adds it.
Yeah. And she's good. Sometimes you can have, you know, corny lyrics and someone delivers them in the right way and it works. So I recommend it. It's good. Speaking of corny song titles, U2's stand-up comedy from No Light on the Horizon. Terrible title for a song, but the song itself is really good. I really like it, and does feature stand-up over and over as part of the kind of through line of the song. So I'm going to throw that on there. And then finally, it took me a while to come up with a third one, but I'm going to put on Sunday by Joy Oladokun, kind of one of my favorite artists lately. And the reason I put this one on there is because so she grows up in the church and comes to understand her LGBTQ identity and doesn't find that there is space for her in the church that she grew up in. And so does sing a lot of songs around faith and coming to terms with what it means for her now. And so this song where she's really sort of pleading for Sunday to come back and give her the kind of restoration that she needs, I think is a call for us to check our Sundays and see what they're for and who they're for and what God is up to in them. So Sunday, that's what I got.
I like it, man.
It's been real.
Real vinyl.